This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The American grocery store is where many of us shop for food. The shelves are full, the music cheery, and there are lots of special price deals. But these low prices come at a long-term cost. Writer John Steinman claims the grocery store model is broken. He's written a book that lays out his case and shows why the food co-op is the answer. The book is Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. John Steinman's a former director and president of a food co-op in Nelson, British Columbia, and he joins us from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show, Frank.
And in full disclosure, I too have a long association with food co-ops as a former board member and former board president of the Durham Co-op Market. So, John, tell me about your interest in our food system. How did it start for you?
Well, you know, my interest in food began studying restaurant management, but my interest in grocery stores and co-ops really began when I arrived in Nelson, BC back in 2004. And Nelson's a small place. It's about 10,000 people. We're a hub of maybe 20,000. And as I got there within about a week of being there, I was amazed at how our cooperatively owned grocery store was impacting the local food system. And within a year or two, I was a board director, spent 10 years there at the board level. And throughout that time, too, I was also working in radio, television, putting together my own productions on food and where our food's coming from. I investigated food for 10 years and got to a place where it seemed like one of the most important forces shaping the food system wasn't receiving enough attention, and that's the grocery stores operating in our communities.
Tell us about that impact that you saw in Nelson. What was it?
Well, you know, we have four big grocery stores, and at the time when I got there, there were five. And we have three grocers that are three of the largest grocers in Western Canada, and then our food co-op. And you know, being able to see the different relationships that our grocery store, the food co-op, was having with the local producers was remarkable. In fact, many of the people producing food in our community were not able to get their food into the grocery store shelves. And so this is back in, you know, 2006, before this rapid rise in interest in local food. And our co-op, as have many co-ops across the country, really began opening their doors decades ago to local producers. And of course, in doing so, incubated many small-scale food producers, whether that's a farmer or a baker or a kombucha maker. And I got to know a lot of those people producing food and got to understand that they were only in business because they had a market to sell their products through. And in that case, at that time, that was the food co-op.
So we should probably at this point describe what a food co-op is and how it is different from the big chains that we see very close to us.
Yeah, well, so, you know, the cooperative model is a model that is used in many sectors of the economy. Credit unions are a great example, which are often forgotten as a cooperative. They're a financial cooperative, a consumer co-op. The food co-ops, 99% of them across the country, are consumer co-ops. So they're a business that is owned by the people who shop at the store. And that doesn't mean that they're exclusive to those members. In fact, almost every co-op across the country is open to anybody to shop at. But these are now full-service grocery stores. These aren't the co-ops of the 70s, which were really just selling dry goods and required volunteer labor in order to sustain them. The co-ops of today are full-service grocery stores. And so as a co-op, I myself, for example, can become an owner of that store. So I'm a shareholder along with 13,000 other people at my co-op. And by being a shareholder, that allows me to vote for my board of directors. It means when I walk into the store, instead of saying, hey, do you guys have an apple from that orchard down the road? I can say, hey, do we have any apples from that orchard down the road? And it's a very different relationship. And it's certainly a model that is quite obscure because it's not something we're generally used to in the day-to-day consumerism that we're generally relating with a business that is separate from ourselves. And the food co-op is something that we own.
So it has an impact on two very important products or very important parts of the business as owners, as community owners. It's community values that are reflected in the values of the co-op. That community, as you say, gets to have some input about how you do your business, how you treat your employees, how you treat your suppliers, and how you treat the community. That's one. And also profits. Profits are shared in a very different way than they are with most chain grocery stores. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, the way I describe it where I live, and it's certainly the example I write about in my book, it's what I've been sharing on the road here as I've been on my book release tour, is I use the example of Nelson. And so, again, we have four large grocers, one of them being our co-op. And so one of the questions I often pose to people in my community is, who owns these grocery stores? Who are the people or businesses behind these big names? In our case, we have a Safeway, which in Canada is owned by Sobeys. We have a Wholesale Club, which is owned by Canada's largest grocer, Loblaw. And we have a Save-On Foods, which is owned by the Jim Pattison Group. And so looking behind the scenes at these companies, the person who is behind Loblaw, who has a majority stake in Loblaw, is the third richest person in the country. The Safeway store, behind that is the Sobey family, the 30th richest in the country. And behind Save-On Foods is Jim Pattison, who is the 10th richest person in the country. And so what I describe in our community is that when we walk into these grocers, we are literally lining the pockets of some of the wealthiest people in the country and increasing the gap between the rich and the poor. Where, of course, when we walk into a co-op, because the owners are people in our community, we are returning, you know, that investment back into our community. And in some cases, if there are excess profits, literally back into the pockets of the people shopping at the store.
And that's by law and tax law because of the way you're incorporated as a private. You remember, you are a for-profit business, but because of the rules of incorporation, it can't go back to shareholders. It has to some way or another go back to the community, or that the shareholders can be part of that picture, but in a very different way than a shareholder in those different kinds of chains. And this is important because when you talk of, we can talk about the history of co-ops, but I'd rather talk about the history of grocery chains, because you also detail that in your book. And that's interesting to see the way they evolved, and maybe the story of Cream of Wheat, I think, can help us, of all things, can help us understand the evolution of chain grocery stores and just the way in which profit shapes value when it comes to those stores.
Yeah, the Cream of Wheat example you share is a great one. It's one I keep repeating at all the talks I've been giving across the country. A&P was the first of the grocery giants. A&P formed in the late 19th century and really started to explode across the country in the early 20th century. And by around 1912, 1914, the company had about 4,500 locations across the country. And one of the examples I use of a company that was selling into A&P was Cream of Wheat, the famous breakfast cereal. And Cream of Wheat was selling their boxes of breakfast cereal at 11 cents a box. And of course, Cream of Wheat was selling to thousands of independent grocers across the country. A&P was one of those customers. But what Cream of Wheat was doing, it was asking all of its customers to resell, to price the food on the shelf at 14 cents a box. And this allowed for a level playing field. It allowed for Cream of Wheat to protect its margins. And A&P said, you know what? We're going to not abide by that 14-cent request. We're going to sell this box of cereal for 12 cents, a 1-cent markup. And Cream of Wheat saw this as a threat to their other customers. They saw it as a threat to their business. And Cream of Wheat did something that many food manufacturers today would not be able to do. Cream of Wheat said, we're just going to turn off the tap and stop selling A&P this Cream of Wheat. And what A&P did is, well, they said, well, you can't do that. This is restraint of trade. Took Cream of Wheat to court, and A&P, in fact, lost that case. And so I use it as an example of the sentiment at the time to this rapid rise of the chain grocer. And that level of resistance to the rise of the big chains in grocery and other sectors of the economy lasted well into the late 1970s. It's an era of American history that, as I quote in the book, is a forgotten history of America, this restraint of the big of big food.
Right, but it also, the other side of that is to allow A&P and any other retailer to charge whatever they want, which is what the market should do, shouldn't it? And if they want to charge a higher or a lower price, they're going to have to let the market decide whether that was a good decision. What's wrong with that?
Well, indeed, you know, A&P was the first discount grocer in the country, and they really set in motion what the culture of food is today, which generally is driven by the lowest price is what really allows for a company to be successful. It's certainly what, as consumers, we tend to look for, are those lowest prices, the specials, the deals. And that has been an amazing feat, of course, that the grocery store sector has achieved in allowing food to be as cheap as it is. we today can eat really well, most of us, you know, who can afford to. And that, of course, has come at a cost. And one of those costs that I really try to direct attention to in the book is the impact that this has had on the people producing food. And, you know, I think a great example of this are the small farms operating across the country, where 75% of the small farms here in the United States rely on some form of off-farm income to sustain what they're doing. And so this is the food system that the low price culture has bred. It's exactly now why so many farmers have a really tough time sustaining what they're doing. And it's also pushed out usually the smallest of the producers. And what we're seeing, particularly in sectors like dairy, as one example, is we're seeing the size of those farms getting larger and larger, and yet the money that's coming through the door into those farmers' pockets isn't changing. In fact, if anything, it's going down. And so this has really been the result of the low-price culture, and that's just one piece. Of course, there's the impact that this low-price food system has had on the planet and our communities as well.
Right, because it forces farmers to cut their costs even more, and that means ecological damage, environmental damage, if they have to do that in order to make the ever smaller margins they're getting because of the consolidation. In fact, you point out that I think some of the damage caused by consolidation. There's the famous Walmart pickle example, which you reprise in your book, and I think is a very good one to point some of this out.
Yeah, well, so there's a story there that might be well known to some of your listeners. It got a bit of attention when this happened, but the Vlasic pickle is a famous pickle that you can find on many grocery store shelves. And at one point, they were wanting to sell into Walmart, and Walmart said, you know, we're going to take your pickles and sell them in all of our locations. And they were selling them at $3 a jar, and Walmart is understood to have been making about a penny per jar. And Vlasic, meanwhile, behind the scenes, are looking at their numbers and saying, we're not actually making any money on this. And so they went and asked Walmart, well, can you up the price so we can at least, you know, make a living producing pickles? And Walmart turned to them and said, well, no, we're not going to do that. And if you stop selling us pickles, we're going to stop selling all of your other products on the shelf. And, you know, this is an example of many that are happening within the food system, because as the number of grocers continues to shrink, and that's indeed happening here in the U.S., the power that they're able to now maintain over their suppliers is increasing. And so whereas Cream of Wheat 100 years ago had the opportunity to say, we're just going to stop selling to A&P, the food producers and manufacturers of today don't really have that option, because they are so few customers that they're selling into, and the capital that they're putting into their businesses has to be paid down and paid off, and they need to pay off the financial institutions that are lending them money. They don't have that option to just turn the other way and say, let's find another customer. And so, the Vlasic example is one of many that's now playing itself out across the country.
Still, we can't take lightly the whole idea of lower food prices, particularly in these times when we're seeing ever greater gap between the wealthy and those who have less wealth. For whatever reasons, if we're not going to change the system overnight, the idea of penalizing people at the grocery store when it comes to buying their food does seem to be a rather strict kind of a way of solving our problem, some of these other problems. The fact is that cooperative grocery stores do charge a little bit more. They're more somewhat, although not as much as they used to be, but still at a higher rate than conventional grocery stores. And for people on a budget, and particularly for poor people, this is maybe the only place they can shop. What about that?
Well, absolutely. And, the first thing I think that's important when exploring, you know, the affordability of food is to really just instill that at the end of the day, you know, each of us are just trying to do our best in order to afford the food that we value the most. And I don't in any way think that this book that I wrote or all of these conversations we're having around food are going to transform our relationship to food and food prices overnight. This is something that will take time. In fact, the grocery store sector, like we've been speaking of, the relationship to price and the prices we now expect to pay for food have been evolving for well over 100 years. And so, you know, this isn't something that's going to change overnight. And what, you know, my hope is that as our values change around what we want to eat, this is something that in our lifestyles, we may also choose to change. And so some of us have that capacity to start to put more attention into our food and pay more for food. And in doing so, we, I think, will in the future enable more and more people to be able to afford to eat healthier food, food that's produced more responsibly. And what food co-ops are doing too is making good food more accessible to more people. And even though in some cases, as you describe, the food co-op prices might be more, in some cases, food co-ops are in fact cheaper. Certainly if you're comparing apples to apples, the products on the shelves of a co-op can often be cheaper than you'll find on some of the big grocery store shelves. And I write about this in the book, how there are examples of this happening. And, you know, the other piece too with many co-ops, certainly ones here in North Carolina, the one in Durham is a great example that I share in the book, that is offering 20% discounts on everything in the store every day to anyone who qualifies for low-income assistance programs. And that's substantial. 450 member owners of that co-op are using that service. And this is quite standard across the country, about 10 to 20% discounts across the board every day. And this is a step, I think, in the right direction with co-ops, which have, yeah, often been seen as inaccessible to lower income communities. And there is this now emerging interest in food co-ops among low-income communities. And it's, again, a section in the book that I write about how there is this new interest now in co-ops serving those communities. And it's something that's starting to explore. And I think it really is the next evolution in the food co-op culture.
Well, and you talked about evolution. The fact that they have been growing and that the number of co-ops has grown has also meant a growth in the wholesale industry, which has brought prices down, a growth in the number of farmers who are producing the kind of food that co-op owners insist on in their stores. And as those numbers grow, some of the prices begin to come down. And that's what we're seeing because of this growth and evolution. And also the evolution, so that makes it possible for others to get in. And in neighborhoods where, in low wealth neighborhoods where co-ops may have been out of the question, are now very much in the question and in the mix. And it also brings about the question of evolution of governance. The fact is, you talk about this, those early co-ops in the 70s were not only owned by the community, but they were governed by the community and managed by volunteers. And this was not a good idea. It was the best they could do, to be sure, the best they could do. But now the idea of professional governance and professional management, as we begin to own our own community stores, has really changed things for co-ops.
Yeah, well, you know, the early co-ops of the 1970s, they were really formed as a way to allow for people to eat good food and eat it more cheaply because they were buying in bulk and sharing, you know, that in smaller quantities with the member owners who were all mostly working for the store as a volunteer or the buying club if it was. And a lot of that changed in the early 80s when a lot of that volunteer labor started to disappear because many of the people who started those co-ops wanted to settle down, build a house, raise a family. And what we had was co-ops either having to go the way of the dodo bird or to grow into a full-fledged grocery store with a business model, with general managers, with a management team and a board of directors. And so most of the co-ops we see today are now governed by a classic structure of a general manager and a whole team of managers below them. And then the board of directors is elected by the member owners to first and foremost employ the general manager and set the strategic direction for that co-op.
And it's really been an experiment in democracy in terms of how you negotiate many of the competing, often competing values that are held within the community. And where ideological wars had tanked many of the early co-ops, these things are negotiated much more intelligently these days because of the amount of experience.
Yeah, and you see a bit of both of that. You know, some of the larger co-ops have really refined the business so that there isn't as much engagement from those ideologies at the board level or from the members. There are still many co-ops, though, that do rely on some pretty direct engagement from boards of directors. And some of, you know, the ideologies that might come in, I think, is what really sets co-ops apart. It is what strengthens them. And at the same time, it can also weaken co-ops. And most co-ops, though, that I've been traveling to and that I write about in the book have got to this place that I think has made them quite resilient. And certainly the biggest challenge right now for many co-ops is competing with stores that are carrying a lot of the same products that co-ops have had at one point being a niche. And now we're seeing a lot of those same products. And so co-ops are right now trying to really communicate what makes them different. And that sort of governance model, the head office of the grocery store being within the store itself at a co-op, is something that really sets the co-op apart from the big grocers. And so while the products
I'm going to have to stop you right there, but I want to thank you. John Steinman, author of Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops and the Age of Grocery Giants. Thanks so much. Going to be at French Broad Food Co-op in Asheville tonight at 7. There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.